Coming up on Boston Public Radio, you know that law that'll create three casinos and a slots parlor? Well, some people want voters to repeal it. One of them, former Attorney General Scott Harshbarger, joins us. Medical tourism. Have you traveled overseas to have a medical procedure done because you can't afford it here? Many have. And then a local doctor who spoke at a White House conference on gun safety joins us. But has the gun control train left the station with very few on board?
Brian McCrory, editor of The Globe, joins us. He's going to talk about the new owner of The Globe, who's also the owner of the Red Sox, that's John Henry. It is August 7th today. Halloween candy is already on the shelf, reminding us that summer's coming to a close. Does retail rushing from Halloween candy to fall clothes everywhere drive you nuts? And then a dance craze that's all the rage in Chicago has come to Boston. Full details on that and much, much more on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Eakin. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So for years, they battled on Beacon Hill over whether to bring casinos to Massachusetts. And finally, in 2011, it passed, promising three resort casinos and a slot parlor. Well, some in the state won't take yes for an answer, so they filed a question headed for the 2014 ballot, which would allow voters to repeal the law, meaning no casinos and no slots. We'll get your thoughts on this in a minute, but first, joining us is one of the advocates for repeal, former Attorney General Scott Harshbarger. Scott, great to talk to you.
Good morning, good afternoon, excuse me, to Jim and Marjorie.
It's okay. How
My
are you?
Pleasure.
Glad you're here, Scott Harshbarger. So, you know this, Scott. The legislature obviously approved casinos. Governor Deval Patrick signed the law allowing the casinos. Polls, most recently, just a couple of weeks ago in Everett, showed people overwhelmingly, and that's one of the proposed sites for casino, want this. So why are you trying to repeal the law?
Well, first of all, we think it is bad public policy and have consistently opposed it for reasons that have more to do with the other strengths in Massachusetts. That is, we have so many other major economic opportunities in this state that to go the route of casino gambling and slots simply is bad public policy. But having said that, the most important thing right now is that the people have never really spoken on this, Marjorie. The reality is the legislature passed it, the governor signed it, yes. But look at the voting. I mean, even though they're losing in certain places, look in Springfield. MGM spent over millions of dollars and only won that $13,000 to $10,000. You're seeing around the state small grassroots organizations developing strongly. And it's simply an opportunity for the people to vote on this. If we lose, we lose. But what is the objection, as we're even hearing in Boston? What's the objection to a citywide vote in Boston? An objection to statewide vote as to whether or not casinos and slots in Massachusetts are good public policy. That's what this repeal is all about. That's why I'm very interested and excited about it, because maybe for once the people will get a chance to register yes or no.
Hey, Scott Harshbarger, though you say it's bad public policy, give us a couple of reasons why it is.
I think, first of all, one of the interesting signers of this is a very courageous and very effective urban mayor, Joe Curtatone in Somerville, who makes the point very clearly. Look, this is not economically sustainable development strategy for Massachusetts. It has huge costs. It drains the tax base. It discourages other kinds of development. And look at what he has been able to do in Somerville, developing sort of long-term smart growth plans. Look at the proposals in Boston. Bill Walczak raises the question, why a casino in East Boston instead of an innovation district? Why not other economic alternatives? That's one major reason.
Well, just on that, Scott Harshbarger, for a second, about 3 or 4 years ago on the radio, when one of the times when then Congressman Barney Frank was yelling at me, one of the things he yelled was in response to that argument, so Jim, here's my suggestion. Let's build the casinos, create tens of thousands of jobs, and when you, and you didn't mention your name, and people like Scott Harshbarger come up with better jobs for those people, then we'll shift them there. This is the only idea that's realistic and fast, was his position. Why is he wrong?
Well, first of all, with all due respect to Barney, I mean, he's wrong on that for Massachusetts. So look around the country, Mid-Atlantic states, New Jersey, Connecticut, they've all gone to casinos. Detroit, they go to casinos as their economic tool. It does not succeed. It does not bring other jobs in. In fact, it's a barrier to them. Look, the other side of this, Jim, is that aside from the economic development, which I think is a very important, I mean, look at what we've done in the seaport, the city of Boston has done in the seaport, the Innovation District. Look at what mayors like John Mitchell in New Bedford are trying to do in their communities. Casinos, I mean, I just think the casinos will stop other kinds of development. But that aside, who wins in this? We know that the casino owners will make huge profits. We know the state will get revenue. But where are we going to deal with the public health costs, the preventable addictions that come with this? What about the cannibalization of all the local businesses that will be affected by this? What about all the other kinds of costs that are never taken into account? And maybe most importantly, just go back to the economic development. I want to see them guarantee those jobs. This is the point. Look at all the agreements. Nobody ever guarantees. We will guarantee you 4,000 jobs, guarantee you 7,000 jobs. And if we don't do it, we will pay you back.
Hey, Scott.
None of those kind of guarantees.
You know, we're talking with Scott Harshbarger, former attorney general, and who is a part of this coalition that wants to have a vote on, and wants to repeal the casino deal statewide. You know, Scott, I'm not crazy about casinos either, but you look at a city like Everett that has been trying to get economic development going for years and years and years. Everett is a tough town.
Right.
They just voted in June, 86-13. They want to have this casino developed by Steve Wynn, the Las Vegas developer that has everything float on water. I don't know how he does that with the chairs and the tables floating on water. Everything looks like it's floating out there. They want to, New Bedford has the waterfront, it has the fishing business, has a lot of things going for it. Boston obviously does. Everett doesn't have that much.
But Marjorie, if that's the, let me just, two things. One is, first, just look 500 yards across the water to Somerville. They supposedly had nothing going for them.
Yeah.
Look at what's happening in Somerville with a strong mayor, a public-private partnership. Maybe it's longer term. Maybe it takes more time. But there are examples in Massachusetts of longer-term development. And that. But the other side of it is, Everett is a good example. In my opinion, that is, yes, it's influenced by Wynn and wanting something, wanting an opportunity because nothing else has been offered. But the other piece is, where was the money? Who spent the money? Steve Wynn spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in that election. The opposition, the grassroots citizens opposing, had no resources at all. In other words, the challenge here is this being done solely because of the real belief that casinos and slots are a real necessity, a real asset to Massachusetts, or are they being done because it's following the money? And then the special interest, the people who will profit at the public's expense, and the people are having no voice, broadly speaking, in this. What we're seeing is, in neighborhoods where it's coming, you're seeing much more opposition than we've seen before. That's why these statewide coalitions, I think, are going to surprise people when you put together the different groups, whether it's in Everett, East Boston. I mean, they're very strong, active citizens who have no stake in this other than the belief that their community can do better.
Hey,
and that's what this vote is all about.
Scott Harshbarger, I want to return to the money issue in a second, but when you say people really haven't had a vote, well, they have reps and senators who voted on it. They have a governor who supported it. And to follow your argument to its natural extreme is then the people should get to vote on every law, essentially.
Oh.
Why isn't that essentially what you're arguing?
Well,
representative democracy spoke.
Sure. I mean, look, I believe in representative democracy, and I think that this is also, I guess in this case, and one of my feelings about this, Jim, has been, not to go back too much in history, but my recollection was that over 100 votes switched on one simple reason in the House of Representatives.
Different
there was
speaker.
A new speaker of the House.
Right. DeMacy opposed it. Bob
right.
DeLeo
yeah.
supported it.
Yeah, 100 votes changed. That's not exactly the people's will. That wasn't done
yeah.
because of an outpouring of citizens' insistence. And Deval, who I admire and respect, never mentioned a word about casinos being his number one major economic development tool. So when he was running for office. So it always happens. And remember, this deal gets crafted in July, in the summer. I mean, I think this has always been done too much behind closed doors. That is not to impugn the integrity of Stan Rose or anybody who crafted this, because, in fact, our law now in Massachusetts is one of the strongest in the country. I think we did learn some lessons. That gambling commission right now is really exercising adult supervision. Steve Crosby, Jim McHugh, they're doing an excellent job, and that we may well be able to show that we can, if there's a way to do this right, we may be able to do it. But that does not mean that this has been a decision that in any way has reflected the people's will as opposed to the interest that have influenced our elected representatives, which is democracy, yes, but you're supposed to have a vote on that.
Well, maybe we should have the democracy in kind of quotes, especially representative democracy, because you're right. The history of Beacon Hill has been everybody does what the leadership wants, and I think that was a crass example when we went from Sal DeMacy to DeLeo and the two different views. But let me ask you about the whole timing of this, Scott Harshbarger.
Yes.
Because it does seem a lot of the polling that was done that I've looked at today was 2010, you know, just 2 years into a very terrible economy, and some people think,
right.
Although things aren't going gangbusters, things are improving now. How much does that play into your effort to repeal this this casino deal, that things may be getting better financially in Massachusetts and across the country?
Well, that can't be ignored, because what's been fascinating to me over a 20-year period, 25-year period in which I've been involved in this since I was Attorney General, is that this issue comes up each time there's tough economic circumstances, when we can't raise revenue, when there are not jobs, casinos come in as the offer of hope, and they are there, and that's what happens. When there's good economic times, this rarely, and there's even a governor who opposes it or a state officials that oppose it, this doesn't happen. So the way that we get casinos is in tough economic times. And if one thing Massachusetts, I think, can show is that we have figured out, and it's a credit to the public-private partnerships, it's a credit to many mayors, to the governor, to our industrial complex that we have here, that we have figured out ways with high-tech, biotech, healthcare, education. These are long-term sustainable opportunities for this state. We don't need casinos as our economic development. If we want to have them, we should have them, but let's not sell it. Let's not make promises about economic development. Let's just say, look, it ought to be an option. People want to do it. That's a different argument than anybody has ever made in Massachusetts.
Hey, Scott Harshbarger, last thing from me is, as you know, when you were Attorney General, I used to do ballot questions for a living, would
yes.
bring them to your office for...
Remember the tax ones that you used to try to get us to pass?
I can't remember that far back.
Jim was always raising everyone's taxes.
No, I wasn't.
That's what he was doing.
But seriously, Scott, one thing that, as a student of sorts of ballot campaigns... When one
right.
side, doesn't matter how good the idea is of the proponents,
right.
when one side dramatically outspends the other, 99 times out of 100, that side wins.
Right.
The opponents you'll have will be bankrolled by casino interests who have bottomless pockets.
Right.
How can you possibly, even if you are 100% right, how can you possibly compete with the kind of money that the other side's going to have here?
Well, one way I might finally get common cause and some of the good government folks who, my great friends, who for some reason do not see this issue as a money and politics issue, to weigh in and engage. I think this is also an example where people know the money's going to be spent, but this, when people get affected by this, if we can't get the engagement, Jim, that's our problem. But the fact is that money will probably prevail. It intrigues me, for example, that today the initiative petitions, I'm intrigued by the business community raising questions about the tax increases that are being proposed. And they're trying to repeal those taxes that affect them. But I happen to believe, casinos are a broad-based regressive tax that is going to have major social economic costs to it. And we're not seeing the same kind of resistance. So I think this is one of those times where the more people know, the more informed they are, the more likely it is that people will trump money. And that's the hope. If we can't, we can't. That's democracy. You don't get a right to win them. You get a right to be heard. And I just hope the people this time will see this as an opportunity to be heard. We lose, but this is at least a chance for citizens to engage and for the public interest and the people's voice to be heard. And
Scott,
I I believe we'll win.
Is there a website yet for your side if people are interested?
Yes. There is. It's repealthecasino.org. Repealthecasino.org. And
what's
the leaders.
What's repealthecasinodeal.com?
Oh, it's repealthecasinodeal.
Repealthecasinodeal.org. And some of the press releases as .com. It's .org.
Okay. Repealthecasino.org.
And let me just, on this, aside from all the other issues, Jim, thank you for giving us an opportunity to be heard. But look, Kathleen Conley Norbit, John Ribeiro, Joe Curtatone, Sue Tucker, Chris Minow, I mean, they deserve the credit here. They've been out here. They're staking their reputations, putting themselves on the line. This is a no-win in any other way other than possibly a public interest victory. And I'm just very, very – I think they're very courageous, and I hope we can do all we can to support these kind of grassroots activist leaders and you know, get in the fray and get off the sidelines. And I think that this is, you know, democracy is not a spectator sport. This might be one we can win.
Hey, Scott Harshbarger, thanks so much for your time. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Jim and Marjorie.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking the time, Scott Harshbarger.
Judy sends me best, and she'll probably give me a critique that I got too intense and didn't talk enough lately with the two of you.
That is Judy. Judy happens to be Scott Harshbarger's wife, who is a wonderful soul. Scott, thanks.
Okay. Scott Harshbarger, of course, is a part of this coalition that is filing a petition, has filed a petition already, actually, to repeal the casino deal statewide. So what do you guys think? Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, or our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. Keith has already emailed twice. He's complaining about the crime that's going to come with these casinos.
Well, by the way, and Harshbarger, who opposed this all along, he's been very consistent, talked a lot in op-eds he had and speeches he gave during the campaign in the legislature about the potential crime and also addiction issues. We want to know, as Marjorie said, would you support a repeal? Do you think it's a good idea? I mean, this notion that people have a right to vote on something that is as important to the future of Massachusetts, I think, is a good one. You had the most brilliant idea ever about
Charlie
casinos.
Baker.
No, well, he had a great idea.
He had a great idea. One casino.
And let's see how it goes.
And that's it.
Well, and let's see how it goes. Yes. And if it's working, let's do more. But even a better idea, I would argue, was no casinos. Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney said, let's go to Connecticut and say, we're going to build casinos. They're going to take away traffic from you. Instead of doing that, you give us $250 million a year, and we will build no casinos. Wouldn't that have been a wonderful outcome? $250 million in revenue for the state and no casinos.
Well, that's the other thing, is that you read these reports about, you know, Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun not doing that well, and they're having difficulties down there. So that's a big issue. And, of course, the issue of the closer you are to a casino, the more likely you're going to have compulsive gambling problems. And the Gaming Commission has talked about how they're going to put in place all these people to deal with the compulsive gambling. But it's sort of a weird situation that the state, at one hand, has the Gaming Commission to oversee the building of these casinos. The other hand, putting aside millions of dollars to deal with the compulsive gambling that's going to result from these casinos. So they're admitting right out of the box that this is going to cause terrible problems in people's lives. My feeling on casinos, I'm not a big fan of casinos, but, you know, you poll after poll after poll says it may be narrow, as Scott Harshbarger says, but there was just a poll of Boston voters. Suffolk University and Boston Herald just a couple of weeks ago, 48% of respondents wanted the casino gambling in Massachusetts. The Everett, where they're...
Poll of Boston people?
Yes, it is. A poll of Boston voters, 48 to 43. They want it.
But let me make an argument, and we'll get to your calls in a second. While individual communities get to vote under the law, I live in Cambridge. We're not about to have a casino. If there's a casino in Everett or in East Boston, it's going to have an impact on my life. Anybody who lives in Massachusetts, it's going to have an impact on their lives.
Everett, where it's going to be located, if the Wynn Casino gets its way and they prevail, I mean, the Suffolk Downs wants one in East Boston. You know, the Wynn proposal is in Everett. They just voted a couple of weeks ago, 83-13. The people of Everett want
the
casino.
Marjorie, I'll talk to
tell Everett to drop dead because I don't want it. I live in Brooklyn.
Handful of years ago, there was a question on the ballot to repeal rent control. every community that had rent control voted over, voted overwhelmingly to keep it, and every community that didn't have it voted overwhelmingly to repeal it.
I don't think
why shouldn't they be allowed to have rent control?
I don't want to go there, Jim, but you know why people voted to get rid of rent control, because it was abused and a corrupt system.
No, you're missing my point. Wealthy people were in rent control apartments.
I agree
that you're missing my point. Individual communities that had it said, we want to keep it. Using your argument that Everett wants casinos, why shouldn't they have them? Why shouldn't Cambridge, Brookline, and Boston been able to keep rent control since they wanted it?
Did Brookline want to keep rent
control? Every community that had rent control voted to keep it, I believe.
Anyway. The deck was stacked, Jim.
877-301-8970. By the way, the process for this, they've got to get the Attorney General, Martha Coakley, to say it's constitutionally permissible, which I assume she will, since a former Attorney General helped draft this thing. Then they have to collect about 70,000 signatures from voters, then another 10 or 15,000. And if they do all that, it's on the ballot in 2014. And what you guys decided to do when you vote will be binding.
Sean from Dedham, what do you think about repealing the casino deal? What do you think, Sean?
Good afternoon, guys. Here's my idea. Why don't we vote to repeal mass bike tolls? And how about placing a courthouse on much sought after waterfront property? how about voting on opening up Lieutenant Governor's phone record? How about gay marriage, Jim? I'm sure you're going to jump crazy on this one.
No, you don't want to know something?
How about EBT offenders that crash cars on the highway and then tell the police officers that they're fools for paying for their own food?
Oh, yeah, that was
the woman that hit
the guy in the Globe truck and nearly killed the guy in the Globe truck. That was Boston Herald's got a great and upsetting story about that today, Sean. Thank you for mentioning
it. Yeah, but by the way, Sean, I asked Harshbarger essentially the question you're raising. How do you decide what goes before the voters and
That's what I'm getting at, Jimmy.
And the answer is, with the exception of, this is Article 48 of the Constitution, by the way, and it precludes ballot questions on bills that include appropriations. Other than that, if you don't like a law in this state, we're one of, I think, 26 states that allows you to collect signatures and try to repeal it. So, Sean, when you're on your rounds every day, just start collecting signatures on whatever you don't like, and then call us and tell us how it's gone.
Yes, Sean.
Let me talk to someone who speaks reason. Madri.
Yes.
Here's the mantra here. Not in my backyard. Okay?
That's true.
I don't gamble anyways, but not in my backyard.
That's true.
Put it in Cambridge.
Sean, thanks for the call. By the way,
Sean has a great point. I mean, many people who want casinos, they just don't want them in their hometown. So that is a problem. But Everett does want it in their hometown. And that's where, like I said, they really want it. They're a struggling city. It's not going to be like Somerville. I mean, you've been to Everett. There's a difference between Somerville and Everett in terms of the housing stock and all those kinds of things. Everett's like my hometown of Fall River. They want them in Fall
River. It's going to have an effect on neighboring communities. They're not getting a vote. And if Scott Harshbarger says they should vote. And by the way,
I don't think Cambridge should be allowed to vote.
Speaking of not in my backyard, I interviewed a couple of years ago the head of Caesars International, who happens to live in a western suburb. He asked that I not say what community. My final question, and he was obviously effusive in favor of casinos, my final question was, would you want a casino in your hometown? What was his answer?
No.
No. And I interviewed the House member, the chair of the House committee that was in favor of casinos, asked him if he wanted a casino in his hometown.
Nobody does. What did he say?
Nobody does. That's right.
Well, I mean, again, Atlantic City. I mean, people point to this all the time. What's the classic line about Atlantic City?
From a UMass Amherst professor.
Yes.
The line was, Atlantic City used to be a slum by the ocean. Now it's a slum by the ocean with casinos.
I know. I mean, that's the dilemma for Everett, because there's not much evidence that a big casino in Everett is going to turn around the economic problems of
Everett. But one argument we haven't come up with, which is the primary argument of proponents of casinos, is you've heard the story 1,000 times. Count all the license plates at Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun. 40% of them are from Massachusetts. If people in Massachusetts want to gamble, they should be able to do it here. And I guess Scott Harshbarger's position, I thought quite openly, was if people vote yes on this and they want casinos, they'll get them.
Let's go to George from Westboro. What do you think about repealing the casino deal, George?
It's ridiculous. But I was going to mention the fact that when Fox was first opened and I was a regular down there, I would count the license plates just anecdotally, because I'm just one person. And my count wasn't 40%, but it was 30% of the cars were from Massachusetts. Maybe it increased over time. And Mr. Harshbarger was indicating that casino gambling is a regressive tax. Well, I noticed that most of the cars in the lots, they were mighty fine cars. So I don't think there were a lot of homeless people down there gambling.
Well, George, if I may, since yours is anecdotal, I wasn't going to mention this, but we'll be anecdotal too. Marjorie and I were talking about casinos in the air about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, and we both felt it was unfair that we were voicing opinions without having been to one. We both drove to Connecticut, and we don't remember if it was Mohegan Suns or Foxwoods.
Must have had a good time.
Well, let me just say, I described it subsequently as being, you know, you talk about high-end things. We entered the slot parlor, which was like a Civil War hospital. It was not exactly a high end, upbeat, happy kind of place.
Those people are not gambling; they're giving their money away.
That is correct.
Well, George, you make the case. You're obviously a gambler. You think that this is a good thing. I mean, you also know, obviously, that a lot of the towns in which casinos are located, including the Mohegan Sons of Foxborough, that the local merchants complain about how their businesses were wiped out by these big casinos.
There's a wonderful place down there on the way that makes the most wonderful pies in the world.
Really?
My kind of guy.
Stotts. Oh, my God, their pies are so good.
S-T-O-T-T.
On their way to the casino and on the way back, they stop at Stotts.
Okay. This man knows what matters. George, thank you for the pie trumps everything. Let's take one more quick one here, Marjorie. Dan in Worcester.
Dan
from Worcester. Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio.
Hi, Dan.
Hello, Margie and Jim.
Hey. Oh, Dan, haven't spoken to you in ages. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing very well, thanks. I don't find myself distraught down the dial normally, but I bumped into you guys this afternoon.
We're glad you're here, Dan.
Thank you very much. Listen, I should listen to what Scott Hashberger had to say, and, you know, he spoke about the people speaking. Well, the people spoke, and this thing has been voted in. Now, they can try to repeal it. That's fine. Particularly, I don't care about the casinos one way or another, so to speak, but I do lament the one-party system in Massachusetts who drove all the businesses out of here, all of the manufacturing whatnot out of here, and we have a lot of cities now in the state that are in need of something. No one's come up with any ideas for anything in particular. These casinos want to come in and spend some dough. I don't know if it's the best thing, but you know what? Somebody needs to get off their rear end and start thinking about maybe lowering some taxation for these corporations who want to come in and maybe manufacture things here again and make it easier for businesses to flourish in Massachusetts.
But, Dan, you know that the unemployment rate in Massachusetts has been below the national unemployment rate for a long, long period of time.
Yeah.
So no one's arguing it's
perfect.
But you
go, but Dan, you're singing my tune, because you do go like to Everett, which I went over to do some stories in the casino, and it's really sad. My hometown, Fall River, it's really sad. You go there now, and they look like, you know, it's the Dust Bowl in the 1930s without the dust. I mean, it's really sad, and I think you forget about it if you're living in Boston, which is, you know, doing well, and Cambridge and Brooklyn, they're all doing well, but these towns are struggling. And that's the
Dan,
thing.
Dan, thanks. It's great to hear from you again.
Jobs now for people
that are
in desperate straits.
Marjorie, I think the thing that you're ignoring that I feel pretty strongly about, regardless of whether one's for casinos or not, the implication that a casino in Everett only has an effect on Everett itself and its people is not real. A casino in East Boston, a casino in Springfield, wherever it is, there's a trickle-down impact. And by the way, some would argue a real positive impact, because it's a lot of revenue for the state.
But I think it's difficult to argue that it's not going to bring some jobs to Everett. It is going to bring some jobs to Everett. And that's the dilemma. We can all sit here and say, well, they should have more economic development in Everett. Well, I think it's occurred to the people of Everett they need more economic development. It's occurred to them for like 70 years, and nothing has happened. And I guess that's sort of the problem. I mean, when you're unemployed, you're unemployed.
You know, one of the issues we didn't discuss, we'll have an opportunity to talk about tomorrow, is there are many people who believe that the casino movement, casinos will be so successful that it will damage the single most successful lottery in the United States of America, which happens to be ours in Massachusetts. The executive director of the lottery, coincidentally, is going to be in studio to answer our questions and yours, Paul Sternberg, tomorrow. So that's one of the things we'll broach with him.
Okay, Scott Harshbarger, you heard him talking earlier. Of course, he's the former attorney general. He's among this group that wants to repeal the casino deal. When we come back, we're going to look at medical tourism and how certain procedures like hip and knee replacements are forcing people to shop for cheaper surgeries in other countries outside the United States. This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy. That's me and Marjorie Egan. So could a healthcare bubble be the next thing that will undo our economy if we can't rein in the nation's $2.7 trillion healthcare bill? One of the many factors contributing to soaring costs are joint replacement surgeries for things like knees and hips, which, by the way, are no longer just for the older among us. It's gotten so bad on that front that many Americans are getting priced out of their own health insurance policies, are paying out of pocket to have these procedures done in other countries. Joining us to go over how things got to this state, what it means for the future of healthcare, and how Obamacare could change things or not is Art Kaplan. Art's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Art, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hi, Art. Thank you for being here. So tell us, why does it cost $13,660 for a hip replacement in Belgium? And, you know, in some cases more than this, but around $125,000 for the exact same deal in the United States of America.
And let's add that that price difference is true around the world. It's cheaper in Canada, it's cheaper in Germany, it's cheaper in France by a lot. So how did we get into that little pickle?
Yeah.
Partly it's because we have never really been alert to the price of what things cost. When you go to the hospital, let's say you go in to have a baby or you break a finger and show up at the ER, you don't really see the bill with the prices on it, and you may never see it if your insurance company covers it, right? You don't get any
right.
price list. Prices bear no resemblance to what things actually cost in American healthcare. You hear all kinds of people saying, we have to get the doctor to use less resources, and there's worries about death panels. The number one problem we have is that our healthcare prices are completely out of control, unaccountable. I don't think I've seen one hearing in Congress on prices.
You know, when reading this piece in the New York Times, Art, that got us interested in this, it's almost like it's a mob operation. I'm
yes,
going down the list.
It's fixed.
They're the actual cost to manufacture a hip, they say, on average, in one of the five places to do it, is $350. There are 13 middlemen between the manufacturer and the surgeon. They're consulting fees to doctors. Some would call them kickbacks. There's a monopoly and non-disclosure clauses in these sales so that you can't compare the price that someone else is paying for the hip itself, the artificial hip from another company. It really is like a mob deal.
Well.
Okay, yeah. Well, maybe not quite like a mob deal. What is it like?
I'm not going to say they go out and break your leg to put a hip replacement in, but short of that, there's a lot of crazy extortion and I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine kind of behavior out there. So consider this. I've talked to pharmaceutical company executives, and they've sat with me with a straight face, and I said, well, look, to get this pill, let's talk pills for a second, I have to pay $1,000 if I go to the NYU Medical Center or the BU Medical Center, whatever it is. If I get it at the VA, it's $250. If I buy it in Greece, it's $100. And the pharma guy will say, well, you know, those other places won't pay the full freight, and we need to recoup our costs from research. We need to have the money available to do the research on the next generation of drugs. So where are we supposed to get it? And I'm looking at them saying, well, go get it in Belgium. Go get it in, you know, I mean, why are we subsidizing the world's research costs with our prices? And we do.
Well, they also talk about, you know, these doctors have a vested interest because they get wined and dined and seduced by these different manufacturers. They were talking about this company that hires sales reps who are good at engineering and good at golf so they can go out with the doctors and convince them to stay with their products, which they stay with forever. I mean, that's distressing as well. The doctors are involved.
Yeah, well, doctors certainly are the targets and have been for many years of these marketing campaigns to get them to use a particular device or to use the most expensive device. We know that drug companies and device companies that make hips have fought for years against generic companies coming in and trying to undercut their prices. That's all the shenanigans that goes on with trying to extend a patent by changing the color of the pill or tweaking a molecule or moving a spring from one part to another. So they're trying to protect those prices. But I'm going to say the number one offender is this. in Belgium, in Germany, in France, the government buys healthcare from the device manufacturer, from the doctors, if you will. It's what we used to call here single payer. Remember
right.
that?
Yep.
So they negotiate the best price. Here, you've got 20 insurance companies, the VA, the Department of Defense, Medicare, Medicaid, the Indian Health Service, who knows who else. Sometimes the doctors, the hospitals, and the manufacturers will give a discount like they do to the veterans. At other times, they just say, you know, here's the price, take it or leave it, this is what it is. We don't have enough negotiating power in the market to drive the prices down. The lesson is right in front of us. It's cheaper in Belgium because they're cutting better deals than we are because it's, you know, you want this device available in Belgium, then here's what the government's willing to pay for it.
So here's the $2.7 trillion question everybody's thinking of as you're speaking. Will Obamacare, if it ever happens, at least full-blown Obamacare, change that or no?
Little bit. Not a lot yet. It really is more an extension of insurance coverage to people who don't have it. Those people used to wind up in the emergency room. You'll be thrilled to know that the highest prices you can pay in American healthcare are for the people who have no insurance, right? They get
yep.
no discount.
Right.
So moving them into insurance should lower the cost somewhat because at least they're getting whatever it is the insurance company can negotiate in terms of prices. So that'll help a little. Obamacare says it's going to cover a bit more in the way of prevention. That'll help because, you know, you don't want to get the asthma attack. You want to get the inhaler into the person. So that's a good thing. But in general, we really haven't confronted this core issue of price. We're dancing around it. We spend $2.7 trillion, as you said. Nobody else per capita spends anything like that. When you're really when you're really trying to drive costs down, it's one thing to pinch at the margins. It's another thing to say, I'm coming right at your pocketbook. And we haven't had any health reform yet that has done that.
Speaking of pocketbook, one of the most controversial provisions in the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare was one that is in the process of being repealed that was particularly egregious because we have so many medical device manufacturers here, the so-called medical device tax. How is that supposed to help keep the prices of things like the hip and all the joint replacement things down? What was the theory behind that?
Well, the basic idea was you want to get something that's more bells and whistles, you pay a tax. It's a copay. Mm-hmm. Think of it that way. You got to pay more out of pocket. I don't have any issue with that, except, yet again, the prices initially are from Mars. They're not. There's no logic behind them. So saying, well, you have to pay 20% if you want that fancy hip that's going to last for 20 years instead of 10, and those are the kinds of differences that are out there. Well, that would be great, except the initial price makes no sense. So to return to where I started, if we're going to really achieve health reform in the U.S. and have more people insured but not go out of our minds with cost, we have to really examine the price structure, hospital price structure, physician fees, what the manufacturers charge. There are a lot of variables that shape that. But let's get a hearing or two in Congress and have some people come down and say, yeah, you know, it really does cost $140,000 to do a hip in the U.S. And it's true it only costs $74,000 in Canada. But, hey, you know, it's we're south.
You know, we're talking with Dr. Art Kaplan, by the way. He's the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center and the co-editor of the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Art Kaplan, this it sounds like a stupid question, and maybe it is, but if we get Obamacare and everybody is insured, the reason this story even appeared in the New York Times is because the gentleman, the snowboarder who wanted the hip replacement, couldn't get coverage from his insurance company because it was a pre-existing condition. So if everybody's insured and everybody can get the $100,000 hip and everybody's making money, the drug manufacturers, the orthopedic people, they focus on this town out in northern Indiana where everybody's thriving. The unemployment's low because of the orthopedic capital of, you know, the Midwest or something. Who's hurt by all the excess money if everybody can get access to health care?
We all are because it means money that could flow to rebuild infrastructure, roads and bridges, money that could go to education, money that could go to food subsidy. We're having a big fight about food stamps, for example. You have a cap on the total amount of money that we can spend in this country, and if you're going to spend close to 20% of it on healthcare at very inflated prices, that's coming out of a pot that's finite, and other things just don't get the expenditures.
Even though insurance companies are paying for a lot of it, not the government.
Oh, yeah, because at the end of the day, what's available in terms of money that you can tax, in terms of what's available in, remember, the big subsidy we have in the U.S., we have a lot of people get health insurance as a pre-tax benefit, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
It's not even generating any income, but it's flowing over to buy that hip. If I wanted to never serve in political office, probably the number one thing you might do is to get rid of that middle and upper class subsidy for health insurance, the pre-tax benefit. It's almost impossible to even mumble that on public airwaves, but it's a crazy subsidy of the rich that bolsters these nutty prices.
Well, look at the reaction from unions who loved Obamacare to the fact that in a handful of years, the so-called Cadillac healthcare plans, the higher-end plans, are going to be taxed. They love Obamacare, but they hate the provision that's going to affect them. You know, Art, my two worst subjects in school were economics and science, so I asked this question with some trepidation. There are more hip and joint replacements in general than ever, because it's no longer, as I said, for the elderly. It's like people who want to stay athletic and active. Our governor just had a hip replacement when he was 50 years old, a year or so ago. So they're manufacturing more. In traditional economic terms, the price should go down. It should not go up. So the conclusion one has to reach is it goes up because it can go up because nobody's watching the whatever it is, the foxes guarding the whatever that thing is. Yes?
And thereby showing that you don't need to take that economics course to realize that you're getting fleeced when people are saying, okay, I'm going to expand the market, and my price doesn't come down one single iota. Now, remember, part of this is there's a little bit of wink-wink collusion among the hip manufacturers, so they know what the other guy charges, and they're both kind of sitting on those prices. And where is the pressure coming from to lower the price? From nowhere. Your governor or the 50-year-old skier, they're ready to pay whatever it takes to get the hip. They're not thinking about the fact that it's cheaper in Belgium. We have to be more price sensitive, and I think we've got to be more demanding about saying, well, what are we getting for our money? The issue isn't do we spend too much? It's the fact is that we're not getting return for what we're spending.
You know, let's talk briefly, if we can, real solutions. You talked about what hearings you'd like to see in Congress. The reality is the likelihood of dramatic additional health care reform in this country, I would say in the short term, is negligible at best. We theoretically did it, and in fact, we may undo part of it rather than expanding it. So within the world of reality, what is a partial fix for this, let's say in the next 15 years? The New York Times story said that by 2030, the cost of joint replacement would be 1/6 of the military budget. So what's the short-term fix here, Art Kaplan?
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you what I think is going to happen rather than the fix.
Okay.
What I think is going to happen is we're going to wind up with a two-class system. The poorly insured, who will get basic care, and their appendix will be taken out when it ruptures, and they will be able to get an inhaler for their to keep their asthma tamp down. But they're not going to get a hip replacement at 50. They're not going to get these latest cancer drugs that extend your life a year for $100,000 or $200,000. I think what we're going to see is a shift away from people who have insurance and people who don't to two classes, the very well-off who get sort of the Cadillac plan and pay for it, and the poor who wind up getting basic care, which is better than nothing, but they're not going to be competing against or securing the bells and whistles of healthcare. I don't see any other way to do this.
One last question for me, Art Kaplan, and I may sound like Pollyanna here, but you know, a lot of people say, you know, when we first passed Social Security way back during the New Deal, it was very flawed and people tinkered and tinkered and tinkered. My hope is that Obamacare has been so controversial and so difficult to get through that if we just get it going, then the chances of tinkering down the road become more possible. Am I too optimistic?
You're a little optimistic. I think it's going to take a crunch to really drive the requisite reform, and I think that crunch is coming in the form of old people.
Yeah.
Who looked at who the big consumers are, baby boomers now entering into their high consumption healthcare years. There is no way current efforts are going to contain their costs. I think that's going to be the crunch that's going to force us back to sort of say we can't pay these rates. We've got to negotiate better prices. We need to hold the healthcare system more accountable for value for what it delivers. And each of us has to pay a bit more if we do want the bells and whistles out of pocket.
Another upbeat discussion with Art Kaplan. Art, it's great to talk to you as always.
Thank you, Art. I'm glad you could laugh about this. I had to start laughing.
I'm buying my ticket to Belgium.
Yeah, exactly. Better book ahead. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone's Medical Center and the co-editor of the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Art, again, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
So what has your experience been? Have you had to participate in what people call medical tourism? Or are you putting off a hip or knee replacement because it costs too much? And how about what Art Kaplan said at the end? Could you live with a two-class health system? The poorly insured, as he says, don't get hip replacement at 50, don't get those expensive cancer drugs, but people on the top in the better healthcare plans do. And by the way, if they're doctors or nurses out there, we'd love to hear what you have to say, too. It's 877-301-8970. This is one of these stories. When Marjorie and I both first read this, it's beyond a scandal. I don't know if we made this clear when we're talking Art. $350 is the actual cost of the mechanism, of the device that is more than likely manufactured in a place called Warsaw, Indiana. $350. And then the surgery, with all the bells and whistles attached, can cost as much as $100,000 in the United States, $13,000 overseas. And as I said to Art, there are 13. I wasn't making this number up. It's from the New York Times. There are 13 middlemen and women between the device manufacturer and the surgeon who puts it in that caused the price to – it is a scandal. But you know how you get this? For those who argue, which is the vast majority of Americans, we want government out of our health care. If there are no government controls, the reality is this is what you're going to get. You're going to get these out of control, obscene costs.
Yeah, and they have, and your all your procedures are going to be covered 80% in Belgium, and you have to pay 20% of the cost. And if you want to get private insurance to cover that 20% of the cost, you can get 20% of the cost covered. So there is a two-tier system a little bit in Belgium too, but not quite as dramatic.
Yeah, but 80% of 13,000
is a big deal.
Is one thing. 80%, even if you're lucky enough here to have it, 80% of 100,000 is a whole different animal.
Well, I also didn't realize until I read this story. I mean, I had heard about medical tourism. It was for things like going to Brazil for facelifts and breast enhancements. So I guess they're really good at it down there in Brazil, and it's cheaper. I'd never heard of it for something like this, which is pretty necessary, especially if you're a snowboarder like this guy was.
And or if you want to stay active. I mean, that's the trend that we mentioned, Art, is dramatic, as it used to be for really older people just to be able to be mobile and get around. And now it's for people who want to stay active, who probably could exist without it but want to lead a higher quality of life. Really depressing. 877-301-8970. We want to get your thoughts. Let's start with AJ and Gardner. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, AJ.
How you doing?
Excellent. Thank you.
I was actually wanted to mention my wife actually works in a billing office for a hospital, and she was actually telling me about some of the how out of control and wacky the pricing is, just as we were just discussing. It's a lot of the pricing is actually varied depending on the type of insurance that you have, and even depending on the amount of co-payments that you have, the amount of deductibles you have. The price that is finally set that they send to the insurance company is based upon what your personal coverages are. And then a certain price on Medicare may not necessarily be the same for Blue Cross Blue Shield, and even as a smoker or a non-smoker. Then they have 90 days to get it sent in. Then if they don't have it in time, they have to write off the entire bill where the hospital doesn't get paid at all. Or they get it in, and then the insurance company turns around and says, no, we're not paying this amount, we're going to pay this amount. And it kind of turns into a battle for about 3 months, and then they write it off.
Well, you know, AJ, isn't it also true? I mean, I know I've read this repeatedly, that the costs vary on the hospital you go to. If you go to a big place like Mass General Brigham and Women's, it's going to be more expensive than if you go to some small community hospital. But everyone's afraid to go to the small community hospitals.
Definitely. Father actually passed away in Mid-City in Worcester. And we found out later where we had taken him to Athol Hospital. He could have had a lot of the same procedures done there. But because he was there so late at night and everything, they wanted to get him into Worcester as fast as possible. In the heat of the moment, you're not thinking about it. You're thinking, no, I just want to save my father's life. Then you follow the ambulance down there. Cool, we're in here. Berated whatever, top so many heart hospitals. And turns out we could have probably kept him in a cheaper hospital and then all the expenses in the end wouldn't have really been quite as drastic.
Yeah, but of course,
had insurance and right. everything. It really took a huge toll on us as a family too.
AJ, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. You know what ultimately is going to be the solution here? It's not going to be a two-class system of health coverage. It's going to be you go on eBay, you buy the replacement hip, and you have a local carpenter install it for you.
Or you bring it to your service where you have to get the car done. You know, a lot of great mechanics there.
It's really amazing.
You know, Diana just emailed and said she changed from Tufts to Blue Cross, and her expenses are much more with Blue Cross out of pocket than they were with Tufts. I don't understand what that's all about
either.
Well,
it depends on the plan, obviously. There are tons of different tiers of plans within every health insurer.
Well, she's having a difficult time with Blue Cross, which I always heard was a Cadillac of health plans, shows what I know. Kate from Brighton, what do you think about this terrible medical tourism story out of Belgium?
I just wanted to bring up that there was a study a couple of years ago called the Dartmouth Report, and it pointed out that healthcare costs move in the opposite way from the market. So usually when you have competition, it drives prices down. But with medical costs, it drives prices up because people want the most expensive care, even if it's not better care. Also, with something like a hip replacement, sometimes people want the best hip replacement, but even though I know you were saying that, you know, a lot of hip replacements are for people that are 50 nowadays, a person that's 80 doesn't need a hip that's going to last for 100 years.
And well, that's true.
Well, you know, there's another end of that spectrum, Kate. One thing we didn't mention with Art Kaplan from the New York Times story, there are feminine knees.
That's the term
they use. If you are, you know, you're not that 80-year-old person and you want the most attractive knee replacement, there's slimmer replacement prosthetic, well, they're not, whatever they're called, devices that cost more money, which sort of, you know, makes your point. Kate, thank you for the call.
Well, you know, I was thinking when I was reading this story, too, remember in all the marathon stores of people that need the prosthetic legs, how expensive they are, and you wonder if the same deal is going on here that is going on with hip replacements. You presume it is.
Well, there are also a lot of these device companies that make the prosthetic items have been incredibly generous in terms of donations and that sort of
thing.
But obviously, that's aberrational.
We'll see what happens in 3 years.
No,
I
understand. No, I'm talking about because it was the marathon. I don't mean in terms of general need that people have. What's next?
Marjorie from Weymouth. What do you think, Marjorie?
Actually, it's Marty.
Oh, I'm sorry. Marty.
That's okay. I have a comment. I have a 40-year-old son who had a partial hip replacement done in New York. And the hospital, while they don't state specifically that they don't take insurance, basically is not in any network. And so, therefore, anybody who is using their insurance has to use their out-of-network coverage, which my son did have. But the coverage is only 60%. And so 40% of a really expensive procedure is, you know,
huge.
A lot of money.
Sure.
And what happened is both he and a friend who had a very similar, they both had a similar injuries, been in pain for like 15 years. They both researched it for about a year. And his friend was going to go to India to have the same procedure done because he did not have the same kind of coverage and couldn't pay out of pocket as much. And they found that... this was a doctor who had actually been a partner and had been a student of the doctor of the one my son was using in New York. He learned all the techniques and now has gone back to India. And so my son's friend is going to India where he's going to get it much cheaper and be able to pay out of pocket.
So how'd it go?
How'd
it go? Did he have the replacement done yet or not?
My son has had his replacement done and he's doing very well. And his friend is scheduled to go, I think, probably in about a month. But I think they both felt pretty confident because it was the same doctor who was actually on his staff was, you know, being trained by the same
doctor. But you know something, Marty? That's a great call, but think about that. I mean, I've never been to India. I don't know anything about India. It's pretty horrible to think that you got to go to India so far away from home, so far away from your family in a foreign country to undergo a medical procedure. That's a really scary prospect.
No matter how high quality the doctor is in the medical care.
Exactly, because it's, you know, the facility and it's the support staff and the infections and post-operative complications. So my son definitely, you know, preferred to kind of, he actually took out a loan to pay for the copay.
Oh, my God. Marty, thank you for the call. Let's take one more quick one. Colleen, you're in Newton. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Colleen.
Hi.
Hi.
Two things I'd like to talk about. One is concierge medicine.
Yep.
Yes.
Because that's starting to creep into Massachusetts. and that's going to have a big impact. And the other thing was that I grew up in Canada, and I have a lot of relatives that are still there. And from what I understand, they don't provide as top care to people who live there as we do, as we get in the States. And what Canada does is it will send some of their really difficult patients to the United States to get their care and pay for it through the Canadian insurance. But it means that they don't have to have the same level of expertise in Canada. They don't have to pay to have the same level of expertise.
By the way, there's an endless debate, as you know, about the quality of the single-payer system in Canada. But just getting back, Colleen, to the first thing you said, for people who don't know what concierge practices are, you pay a premium, essentially, for a practice that has a limited number of patients.
Right.
You get to see those doctors faster, sort of like first class as opposed to coach on an airplane, and you pay a differential. Colleen, thank you so much for the call. And by the way, a lot of people are worried in light of the crushing burden that so many primary care physicians face that concierge care is the wave of the future, which would be not a wonderful thing for, I guess, the middle class.
You know, Keith just emailed about his son who has a very serious mental illness and said that MassHealth did better treating him than Blue Cross and paid for a nurse to come to the house when Blue Cross wouldn't. So,
by the way, we should let's be clear here before we leave. There are horror stories about, I'm not defending or criticizing insurance firms, there are horror stories about virtually all of them, and there are celebratory stories about all of them, too. So we should try to keep it in some context.
Okay. I mean, I shouldn't have been picking on Blue Cross.
Well, I mean, no, I think the answer is because some plans work great and some plans within a healthcare system don't work so great.
Okay. Every 6 days, a child under 15 dies from an unintentional firearm injury. When we get back, we'll talk to a local physician who is working to change that. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Gun control was obviously the hottest topic in Washington for a while. Then it began to fizzle. Joining us in the studio is Dr. Robert Segge. He's the director of the Division of Family and Child Advocacy at Boston Medical Center and a professor of pediatrics at Boston University School of Medicine. In June, he was invited to the White House to talk about firearm safety, and he has a terrific editorial in the August issue of Pediatrics, which I'm sure you all subscribe to. And since you don't, he'll tell us about it. Doctor, it's good to see you again.
Thank you very much for inviting me back.
Thank you for coming in. So I was embarrassed by what I did not know until I read your editorial. Doctor, tell people what the basic argument here is in your piece.
Well, the argument, the editorial was about an article that appeared in Pediatrics of a small study done in a hospital where they asked kids who came in with an injury if they had access to a gun. And the study showed that the kids did have access to a gun. But what my editorial was about was the United States government does not fund research about firearms injuries. It's the number two killer of young adults, second only to motor vehicle crashes. Last year, the United States spent $102,997 on firearms research. And I believe that's a very small part of the U.S. government's budget.
And we should keep in mind, this is not shouldn't be, at least in my estimation, one of the hot topics about whether or not you have banned assault weapons. This is just core research so that you can theoretically make informed judgments about what's happening and what isn't, right?
Oh, absolutely. Really basic stuff. These kids came in, they'd been in a fight. They have access to guns. What are they planning to do? What can we do as a public health agency to prevent them from getting guns? What motivates kids to have revenge? Can we use emergency rooms to monitor how well we're doing on reducing gun violence? All of these things. We don't know.
Well, to put this in perspective, you talked about the Center for Disease Control, which has a budget of $6.5 billion. And you referenced we've done good work on, you know, cigarettes with kids and obesity with kids. We're getting there anyway, and obesity with kids, we still have a problem. But as you just said, we're spending nothing on gun violence and children. And now I suspect this has to do with the gun lobby. Is that what this is about? Is this about the NRA putting pressure on Congress to slash this kind of research?
That's exactly it. So what happened was in 1996, I think, there was an article that compared how many Americans died from firearms injuries to citizens of other rich countries. Not surprisingly, we did worse. The next year, Congress put language in the CDC's budget forbidding them from doing firearms research. And that has been carried through every year since.
And you sell you in your editorial, you celebrate, and my word, not yours, the fact that the Obama administration is proposing $10 million for this research. But what's to celebrate? The likelihood of it getting included in the final budget for the CDC is the same as the likelihood of an assault weapons ban, is it not?
Well, I was at the White House about a month ago, and Vice President Biden was optimistic about it. And the political
research element you're talking about.
The little $10 million out of the $6.5 billion budget. And he was optimistic because the senators who voted against the common sense extension of background checks, they were killed in the polls afterwards. And the senators who broke ranks with the NRA and voted for common sense extensions of the background check saw their poll numbers increase.
But it seems to me, Doctor, and I don't know if this is the case, is that if I were a member of Congress who's opposing this research, since it's very hard to argue that you don't support research into an issue that, as you say, is the second cause of death of kids, the argument you make is this is just a thinly veiled backdoor way for gun control advocates to get into the discussion. So it seems to me that one of the critical elements, we'll actually ask some callers in a minute if they fall into this camp, one of the critical elements would be to get some of those senators, for example, who don't oppose what you called the common sense, the Manchin-Toomey bill, the sort of modest expansion of background checks, to say, hey, I'm not about to vote for any gun control measure, but I surely want to know how this is affecting the children of America. Are any of those people supporting this research?
Well, it hasn't come to the floor yet. I hope so. I'm optimistic. I think it will. I think after the Newtown massacre, Americans are sick of this. And they really
but not sick enough to get their elected officials on board.
Well, I hope they are.
Our number is 877-301-8970. While we're talking to Dr. Sager, I'd love to know if there are people who don't want to see Congress. Well, we'll hear from anybody, but we don't want to know if there are people who don't want to see Congress do anything on assault weapons, don't want to see Congress do anything on high-capacity magazine clips, and don't even want to see background checks expanded, but who do think that this is a sane way to proceed, get the data so that people we send to Washington can make informed decisions.
Dr. Sege, I wonder if you see young people in your practice at all at Boston University School of Medicine who have been victims of gunshot wounds. Have you seen that over the years?
Oh, absolutely. I took care of a young man this week who had recovered from a wound to the hip, and he has a tattoo on his arm. So I asked him, it was a date, and I asked him what the tattoo was, and he said, that's my cousin's birthday. And he grew up with his cousin. His cousin was killed 5 years ago in Boston. I see this all the time. I never, ever want to see it again.
So you see children that you're treating for gunshot wound injuries who have also lost family members and friends and classmates and uncles and cousins to gun violence.
I saw him for something entirely unrelated. He had another health condition. Mm-hmm. But he himself had that experience, but he had lost relatives. I've had parents in January. I had two different families come to me for help explaining to their young children why a loved one, an aunt, a father, had been killed, and how you can tell a four-year-old they're never going to see your aunt again.
So let's assume that your way and the Obama administration way carried the day in Washington. What information would research give us that we don't know now that we need?
Well, some of it we already know. We know, for example, that a lot of the guns that in crimes come illegally, that people buy them for their boyfriends or husbands, even though they're felons. But the other things that we know is what motivates people. Are there weapons that would personalized weapons make a difference? If you have a weapon where you have to be wearing a ring that has some electronic
signal, it would only work for you. You're the only person who could fire that weapon.
Would that make a difference? And what about social customs? What about norms? Because now we have a thing where if you're drunk, you have a friend driver, you have a designated driver if you're going out drinking. What do we know about the social norms that make it okay for someone to carry a gun? Why is it okay to carry? How do we know how to affect that? And all of those questions that have done a huge amount to reduce things like automotive fatalities, drunk driving. You mentioned obesity, cigarettes. What public health campaigns might be effective at reducing gun violence? How do families make decisions about gun ownership, about where to store their guns? What kind of things would would actually be acceptable to American families that would reduce the violence.
And what do you? What does a doctor do? For example, it's just the, within your realm, Boston Medical Center, or any of your colleagues elsewhere. What do you ask and not ask when you're interviewing a kid? I know there are a lot of parents that say, ask about why my kid is there and stop. I don't want to hear you asking about whether there's violence in the home, whether anyone's got a gun. Just ask them about things that are relevant to their treatment and let them go. What do you ask? What do your colleagues ask?
Okay. Well, I'll just answer for myself. You know, when kids are toddlers and they're running around, I ask, where do they store the laundry detergent? Right? I am a fan of laundry detergent. I also ask if they have guns in the home.
And if you do.
Yeah. And if they do, how do they store them? How do they keep them safe from the child? Because we know that in the United States, four-year-olds kill each other with guns they find. They're curious. And I talk to them about that, just like I talk about laundry detergent. My own opinions about guns are – they're my opinions. But helping families with the information they need to keep their own children safe is really important.
But, you know, one of the things you know as a pediatrician, and one of the things just being a reporter over the years you learn, is that a lot of kids get guns illegally, and they do get them illegally, because they're afraid of other kids on the street. So they get them as sort of a self-protection kind of issue. So this is a huge problem for living life in tough areas of town here and all across the country when you're a teenager.
Yeah. So what I think about that is, if you don't have a gun, you're going to feel afraid.
Right.
If you feel afraid, you might avoid certain places and times. If you have a gun, you might feel more secure. And then you might not avoid those dangerous situations. So it turns out that the public health information that we have is that if you have a gun, you're more likely to end up in a situation where you're going to be in danger. So it doesn't actually save you. But this is when I talk about the need for public health research. There's a little bit of research now and again, but why do kids carry guns? What kind of messages would help them? How can we address their legitimate safety concerns in a way that actually makes them safer? These are really important questions.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking with Robert Sege from the Division of Family and Child Advocacy at Boston Medical Center and a professor of pediatrics at Boston University School of Medicine, about the fact that we are not doing a very good job with young people and guns, and the shocking bit of information, which I, like I said, did not know until I read your piece, that the Center for Disease Control, which has a $6.5 billion budget, is spending almost none of it, $100,000, which is terrible, on gun research. I just want to ask you about the politics of this before we get to the phone calls. I would assume people do try to change this over the years and get more money in the CDC for research, correct?
Yeah, that's true.
And so these mavericks propose these things and get ignored and voted down.
Yeah, because it's sort of buried in the CDC budget. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find it. I think the Obama administration has singled it out.
Yep.
And it's going to become a political issue in a way that it hasn't been since it was first passed in 1996.
But do you get sense, when did you say they were there? In June with
Vice President Biden.
Yeah. And who's been a point person, obviously, for the president on this. He's met with the Newtown family, spent a lot of time with them. That was after the defeat of the Toomey Mansion compromise. Do you get the sense that other than the rhetorical what the rhetoric we've heard from both Joe Biden and the president, who had his arm around one of the fathers from Newtown after the defeat and said the battle goes on. I get the sense, long distance, that while they care about this, it's not top-tiered at all because they know it's not going anywhere. Is that the sense you get?
Well, I think that I'm optimistic that they will push it through. It seems like one of the more popular issues in the American public. 90% of the American public back expanded background checks. And I think they're looking for a popular win. I can't tell whether what they really think. I think it's one of the issues that they have a chance to win on.
877-301-8970. I get the question pretty much is narrow today. It's not so much gun control issues, but is anybody against a reasonable amount of money going to the CDC so they can do research devoted to firearm injury prevention? Not research about gun control, research related to firearm injury prevention. Let's start with Nancy in Framingham. You're first with Dr. Robert Sege and Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Nancy.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Thank you for putting me on air again.
Pleasure.
I'd just like to say that the Second Amendment basically deals with having a militia, which I interpret to be the National Guard, which is fine with me, for national disasters. And the tag to that is, you know, I'm probably paraphrasing one, but everyone has the right to own a gun. For the Constitution in this country, we were loaded with firearms in our culture, in our founding from the 17th century on, or the very early 17th century on, and until after, you know, the passage of the Constitution and the establishment of this nation.
Where are you going with this, yeah. Nancy? Where are you going?
I just want to say about children and firearms, I've heard horror stories not only of ghetto children coming across loaded firearms and drawers or lying around and shooting each other with them, which is awful, but I have heard of one story of a very respectable, let's call it middle-class family with loaded arms in the house.
Oops.
Well, Nancy, we lost you. We've all read a lot of those stories. And I don't know if Nancy, I don't know where she was going when she mentioned the militia thing. Whether one likes it or not, gun control advocates have to deal with this. Supreme Court ruled a couple of years ago by 5-4 that the narrow definition of the Second Amendment, that individuals are not covered by that language and the militia language. 5 members of the Supreme Court disagree with this. So the issue is, what battles can you win within that construct? And one of them is this background check thing that was a defeat in the first round. And one is something as basic as research. Let's go to Dedham, where Frank is on with Dr. Robert Segay and Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Frank.
Hey, how you doing?
Excellent. Thank you for the call.
You know, I'm against any, you know, bans on any firearms or anything. But you know what I'd like to see a research on is, you know, what kind of pharmaceuticals were, you know, people like Adam Lanza on? Is there any relation, you know, to that? You never hear, I find it very interesting where, you know, Adam Lanza destroyed all his computers and all his stuff, and we don't know anything about him, and we don't hear anything about him. Yet Aaron Hernandez destroyed all his computers, and we can still find all the information off that.
That is a great point.
I don't think
point,
anyone
Frank.
Ever looks into, you know, what kind of, we know 70% of America is on some sort of drug, from antidepressants or whatever. And what if it turned out these people that do these school shootings were all on the same antidepressant?
Frank,
you raise a great point about mental illness, and a lot of the people that don't want any bans on guns say we should be focusing more on mental illness. We are sitting here with a pediatrician who I hope can tell us the difficulty in getting mental health care for children and teenagers. It's a problem. That is my understanding.
Yeah, getting adequate mental health care is a huge problem in this country, particularly for young people, and I would be the last one to say anything else. But just imagine for a moment that same person went to the elementary school and he had a kitchen knife.
Right.
And he was on drugs. He was mentally ill, whatever. He would not have been able to do nearly that much damage. Part of it is mental health services, which are woefully lacking. But the other part is the availability of firearms. And he got it from home.
But yeah. It was from his mother. Before Frank leaves us, though, how about the answer to Frank's question? Would the kind of research that people like you and your colleagues support give us information about shooters and drugs and those sort of things?
Absolutely. Because I think, you know, people come to the emergency room all the time for treatment. They were involved in a shooting incident. It would not be difficult to do a research project to collect blood specimens to find out what they were taking, what their levels were, see if that how that compares to other population. That's an example of the kind of question we really should be asking, but is not funded.
Frank,
but,
thanks for the call.
But you know, the other thing, to get back to the mental health thing, we hear this all the time. Adam Lanza probably had mental health issues. He looked a little unusual. The kid out in Colorado, mental health issues. The, you know, all these shooters. You hear the guy that in the Gabby Giffords case, Arizona, yeah. How his father was petrified that he was going to do something like this. And yet, we can't even get coverage. We can't get any mental health coverage. I mean, it's sort of a joke. Unless you have the money to go out and pay for it yourself, and it's very, very expensive, it's terrible for children.
Yeah, you know, and the apparently we're supposed to have parity, meaning mental and physical health are treated the same by insurance companies, but it's not true.
It is not true.
And I have a problem in Boston with my patients, and I go around and talk to doctors in other parts of the country, and they say, you can't complain. Boston's great. And it makes me very upset that I think that these kind of problems. The other thing, from a strictly financial point of view, and I'm obviously not an economist, but investing in mental health in children, particularly young children, has very long-term payoffs. And Art Rolnick from the Federal Reserve Board and several others have pointed out that investment in young children's mental health has lifelong return on investment for all of us.
Is there the same divide in the pediatrician community that there is in the general population? Not on the research issues. I hope there's no divide there. But on the whole, the big questions on gun control?
Oh, absolutely not. So this year, every year the AAP has a meeting in Washington.
American Association of Pediatrics.
And they have a meeting where they go and they lobby Congress about one or two issues they pick. This year it was firearms injuries. 90% of pediatricians back our firearms policy, which says the safest home for a child is a home without a gun, and urges the strongest possible, within constitutional limits, gun control legislation. 90% of pediatricians believe in that. I've worked with the current, past, and future presidents of the American Academy of Pediatrics on this issue. The membership is remarkably passionate about it, and it's passionate because they, like me, have patients who've been affected by this, and it just makes you sad.
877-301-8970. Our guest, Dr. Robert Sagi, wrote a piece and after being invited to speak at a briefing on firearm safety at the White House. He wrote an editorial on the topic in this month's issue of Pediatrics, and if you don't happen to get it, the gist of it was that we're spending virtually nothing on research, and that's an important first step in an informed debate about gun issues.
Dale in Randolph, what do you think about funding for research through the Center for Disease Control, Dale?
Well, I think we used to fund a lot of research through the Center for Disease Control. That and the track record of that research is it keeps coming up with the results they didn't desire. That is to say, it had little or no effect on actual violent crime, violence rates, etc. And so the results of these research kept getting published in obscure journals or, oh, we have to rework it and we're not quite ready for publication.
Dale, like, well, I'm not familiar with it, so just give us an example so we know what you're talking about.
Well, I don't have an example off the top of my head. I'm at work right now.
Okay.
And but
so your position is the CDC is not just an objective entity but a political arm, and that's what worries you about them getting money to do what you would consider to be not objective research. Is that a fair statement of where you are?
Pretty much, yeah.
How about that, Dr. Sagi?
Some pieces of the CDC are very objective, but unfortunately it's the political masters at the top of CDC who choose which projects to fund.
Got it.
Okay,
well,
thank you.
Is there some truth in that, Dr. Sagi?
Well, the CDC has a peer review process, just like other federal agencies, so research that's done goes through scientific peer review. I would love to have enough CDC funding to test that and find out how it works. But at the moment, one thing I can absolutely guarantee is if you don't have any funded research, it won't have any impact. And we bought that, and I would love to see whether I disagree with the caller. But we can find out in 5 years if there's been funding.
You know, in light of the fact that as Marjorie has read several times because she's so incredulous, and I'm with her,
$102,997,
and we're quoting from your piece. Well, I do believe it's a government responsibility to provide research on all important issues so that lawmakers and the public can make informed decisions. I'm assuming there are a ton of foundations that are willing to spend a mounds of dough to fund the exact same thing if the government's not willing to do it. I'm not saying that's the way it should be, but that can happen, and I assume is happening. Is it, or am I wrong?
If you have those names of the foundations, I'd be happy to, apply to them.
There are not a lot of these wealthy foundations who care deeply about kids, and if, as you say, and I assume you're right, that if guns are the second leading cause of death of young children, the private sector is not funding this kind of thing?
Not to a significant extent.
Wow. Let's take another call. Wendy from Middletown, Rhode Island. Thank you for calling, Wendy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you.
Every year, I teach in Brockton, Massachusetts. It's an urban setting, and I'm in a middle school. Every year, the kids come to school wearing the T-shirts or the buttons in tribute or memorial to someone they've lost to gun violence. And it perpetuates. It happens year after year. And we as teachers would welcome that kind of research so we would know how to address these issues with children. You know, what to say to them, how to make it stop. It's a continuous cycle. It's traumatic. And we know the scientific research as far as trauma with children, how it affects their brain at different ages. But, you know, how do we as the public or the people that deal with these kids all the time. You know, what do we say to them? And research is so much needed. So thank you for bringing this up.
Thank you, Wendy, so much for your call.
Well, you know, we've, as I say, I've been a reporter, covered murder after murder after murder. And I remember there was a period when there were like 11 shootings in just a few weeks in Boston, several of them fatal. We talked about since the marathon shooting, which we gave so much attention to. We're close to 100
shootings.
Since the marathon.
One a day on
some
average.
Of them get our attention, and most of them don't. But, you know, and you talk to people that live in the inner city, these young men, a lot of them don't think they're going to live very long because they see their guys they hang around with getting gunned down at 18, 19, 20. So it's just a really horrible problem.
Yeah, it's horrible, and it has all those other effects too, because you try to talk with someone who thinks he's not going to live to age 25 about postponing fatherhood.
Exactly.
Or keeping himself safe from STDs or finishing school or all the other things that you know that young person in the room with you is capable of doing, but he's convinced he doesn't have a future. And how do you deal with that? And how do you deal with the feeling of loss that they have from someone? And I think that this is a national disgrace.
Let's take one or two more quick ones if we can. Let's go to Jeff in Framingham, and you're on with Dr. Robert Segge from Boston Medical Center in BU. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
And your subject is really important. But both of them seem to fall under the one story before this and this one. It has to do with healthcare. And being the only nation in the first world that doesn't have national health care is really a shame. And it leads to such things as not having sufficient research, not even past the ability to get mental health care and to get dental health care and a number of other things like that. We don't get to look at how these health issues include gun violence. I would bet that if they did a research program about the effect of guns, you would find that having a gun in your house does not protect you from much of anything, except put you in a danger of one or other of your members of your family getting harmed. And that's basically what I wanted to say. And
you said well.
Pump for a national health care. And
well, you know, Jeff, you know, when you say national health care, we were talking to Art Kaplan a little while ago from obviously the ethics guy from NYU. I mean, we have a modest, I think most people would agree, compared to a national health care reform called Obamacare that the House of Representatives just voted to repeal for the 40th time. So it doesn't appear that kind of health care system, at least, is in our immediate future. Jeff, thank you so much for the call. So if people want to get involved, want to help with this, if they can, I mean, obviously they can call their local reps and senators in New England, most of whom, not all of whom, most of whom support these kinds of things. What else can they do, Dr. Segge?
Well, there are two different organizations that are very active in the state. There's the Mass Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence, which is organizing testimony at state legislative hearings. They're available through the web. And in Boston, Citizens for Safety has a wonderful campaign called Lipstick, which I can try to get this right. Ladies involved in – it's a program to help –
good enough. Lipstick is fine.
It's a lipstick. It's a program to get young women engaged in this because
oh,
they have a lot of – turns out they have a lot of influence on young men. Who knew?
Dr. Segge,
Citizens for Safety, also available on the web.
Thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it, and thanks for your work.
Dr. Segge is the director of the Division of Family and Child Advocacy at Boston Medical Center and a professor of pediatrics at Boston University School of Medicine, and he wrote the editorial on gun safety in the August issue of Pediatrics that we've been talking about. Up next, we're going to be joined a little bit late by Brian McGrory. He's the editor of the Boston Globe. You may know this. The Globe was sold this week to the owner of the Red Sox, John Henry. We'll talk about that new ownership and a few other things with Brian McGrory. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. He joins us every Wednesday at about this time on Open Mic. He is the editor of the Boston Globe. He is Brian McGorry. Hello there, Brian.
Hello there, Jim Browdy. Hello, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm great, Brian. Great to talk to you. So, you know, I read Adrian Walker's column this morning in the Boston Globe. You're a great columnist there, Adrian. And he said that the new owner of the Boston Globe, John Henry, strolled by his desk and mentioned to Adrian that not only had he read a couple of columns by Adrian, but also, quote, by someone named Brian, and they were good. Good sign for you, Brian, I say.
First off, I think you could lose a tone of surprise when you say, and they were good. I would really rather appreciate that. You know, you read tea leaves wherever you can find them these days.
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
So, Brian, we're 4 days in. How are things over there at Morrissey Boulevard? No, really. I mean, come
you
on.
Do you want to talk every day? You know, now we're 5 days in. What's changed? How's it going? That'll be good. That'll be good. You know, things are fine. We are... they're better than fine. I will tell you, the staff is really energized. There's a lot of excitement around this. The idea that we have a local owner who seems to be doing this for all the right reasons, a commitment to the city, you know, the intellectual challenge of trying to turn newspapers around, believing that he can make a profit off this. I think these are all the right reasons to be doing this, and the staff is really energized. About what's in front of us, so I think things are going very well there.
Dan Shaughnessy is still working at the Globe, correct?
Dan Shaughnessy, we had this discussion on Monday.
Yeah,
I know. Today is Wednesday.
Dan Shaughnessy is the safest guy in Boston, job wise, right now. I mean, there's not going to be. Come on, Jim, you know better than this.
Well, you know,
John Henry is not coming in to mess with the sports coverage. He has said it himself. If he tries to play with our sports coverage or Red Sox coverage, he's only diminishing two great institutions. It's not going to happen, and it's not going to happen on my watch. So trust me on that.
Well, you know, I don't know if you saw this, Brian, but Chris Cassidy had an interesting piece in the business section of the Herald today interviewing David D'Alessandro, who, of course, used to run John Hancock. And he talked about how purchases, you know, by John Henry of the Globe and Jeff Bezos, the Amazon founder of the Washington Post, could make newspapers really hot properties again. And these guys, like the two of them, highly technically savvy, and newspapers, according to D'Alessandro, have been trying to break through the blood-brain barrier associated with the technology side. I thought that was sort of an interesting analysis, that newspapers have been with newspaper people trying to turn the tide. Maybe this is a different way to look at really making money off the Globe and the Herald and the Washington Post and every other struggling paper.
I mean, what do I know, Marjorie? But I absolutely believe there's money to be made. And what's interesting about the Bezos purchase of the Post, which is pretty stunning. I mean, that actually was announced as I was standing in the middle of the newsroom talking with the assembled Globe staffers about our sale. And suddenly the Post sale breaks, and we're old news in about 1 minute. What's interesting is these purchases are so different than the rash of newspaper transactions that occurred in the mid-2000s. 2004, 2005, 2006, when papers were selling still at a premium. If you remember, the Philadelphia paper sold for like $550 million.
Yep, yep.
Newsday on Long Island sold for $500 million. The Tribune Company, Chicago Tribune, LA Times, Hartford Current, and others sold for billions of dollars. And the buyers were taking out huge amounts of debt. We're about to go off the cliff in terms of classified advertising and the economy in general. And these papers took a beating. But this new wave of buyers is coming in after much of the bloodletting. They're buying with cash, so we're not going to be paying a big monthly debt service. And if you just base us on our operating costs, we can make money as we make this transition from print to digital. We can do this.
How was your conversation with Marty Baron?
We exchanged emails, and
former editor of the Globe, now editor of the Washington Post. For those who don't know, go ahead.
Terrific editor, for my money, the best editor in America. I can say that now that we're not really owned by the New York Times. He is very excited about the idea of a technologist coming in and running a newspaper. He is also like everybody else at the Washington Post, and I think throughout Washington. A little bit more than a little bit sad that the Grahams are no longer the owners.
They 80 years, eight decades. Yeah.
I mean, they were just amazing stewards from
obviously Kay Graham, who did such amazing work through the Pentagon Papers and Watergate, through some of the best years of the Washington Post, to her son Don Graham, who has been an extraordinary store to the paper, and Catherine Weymouth, who is now the publisher of the Post, who hired Marty Baron away from the Boston Globe last year.
You know, Brian McGroy, I don't know if you are as an avid a reader of the New York Times style section. They often joke the weddings in the back of the women's sports pages and stuff. I am an avid reader, and I was reading every word of the piece on Sunday about Catherine Weymouth, who 47-year-old, you know, she just mentioned her. She's the publisher of the Globe, and it was, I mean, the Globe, the Washington Post, and talking about her, you know, raising the three kids and all the details of her divorce and everything else. It was a fascinating piece, and I'm thinking, this is incredible. This whole big piece is appearing on Sunday, and of course, she already knew that the paper was going to go to Amazon.com. It was,
well, to Bezos, not to Amazon. I mean,
to Bezos, yeah. But it was an amazing kind of timing, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know how this business works. For all we know, the New York Times started working on that story 3 months ago.
Yeah.
They have held in a queue for a month, already written, and, you know, to be unrolled at the exact wrong time. But, you know, if you're Catherine Weymouth, what are you going to do? Call the New York Times and say, don't do this. I have huge news to announce tomorrow.
Nothing.
And,
it's just great.
I mean, you have to just sit there and, you know, let it go.
Sort of like Barack Obama. This is a horrible analogy. At the White House Correspondents' Dinner, when there are jokes about Osama bin Laden when he's already authorized the assault on the compound. Hey, Brian, I'm only going to ask you one more aggravating question today. But it is what everybody wants to know. Any assurances for you? And I know your first concern is your staff. Any assurance that you are the editor of the Globe for the foreseeable future?
Jim, I'm fine. I am fine. I mean, I will do fine. I am fine. I'm not worried about that right now.
Has Henry said anything to you? Has John Henry said anything to you about your tenure?
John Henry and I have had several conversations since he signed the agreement to buy us, but I have every plan to continue as editor of the Globe, and if that changes, I will come on your show and let you know.
But Brian, has he given you an assurance? It's the last time I'll ask.
You're morphing from aggravating to annoying here.
Has he given you any assurance or no?
I haven't asked for assurance. He hasn't given it to me. I don't view it as necessary right now. I just want to go about doing my job, the job I've been doing for, you know, the last half dozen months or so, and we'll see what happens.
You know, Brian,
I have every expectation that this will continue on.
Brian, I don't know if you know that the sale of the Globe has actually made the late night talk shows. If you haven't heard this, here is Jimmy Fallon raising, actually, I think, a pretty relevant issue.
Some business news. The newspaper, the Boston Globe, I love the Boston Globe, has just been sold for $70 million, even though 20 years ago it went for $1.1 billion. Yeah, I couldn't believe that story when I saw it for free on the internet.
That is the challenge, is it not, for the newspaper business in general, not just the Globe, right?
It is the challenge industry-wide. I mean, I wish you'd keep in mind one thing, though, that, you know, we did sell for $70 million after being sold for $1.1 billion. That's irrefutable. What's also irrefutable is the fact that the New York Times took hundreds of millions of dollars in profits from the Globe over the last 20 years, and I have absolutely no doubt they made their $1.1 billion back, plus some. So it's not as if they are selling us. It's some sort of massive loss. They did fine in this deal, but it is, it's indicative of the state of the industry that a paper like the Globe is selling for $70 million, or the Philadelphia Inquirer is sold for $50-something million, or the Washington Post, which used to be valued at a couple of billion, is selling at $250 million. It's where we are right now. Wouldn't it be great if we had this conversation in 10 years and, you know, regarded this as the unbelievable trough, and that these properties were selling for a whole lot more then.
Well, at the risk of sounding like Pollyanna yet again here, sooner or later, I think people are going to realize, Brian, that it's the newspapers that drive the news. They drive what we do here in talk radio. They drive what television does. They drive the news. And there are no reporters. There's no news. And somebody's going to pay those reporters. And a lot of bloggers are doing it for free. So I hope that realization comes around eventually.
Brian, there have been
I don't think that realization has ever been gone. I mean, I think people understand that we drive the news. It's how do you sell the news and how do you sell advertising? And, you know, that's the problem now. When we're giving the stuff away for free online and when classified ads have basically, you know, gone away relative to what they used to be like 6 or 7 years ago, and especially 10 or 15 years ago, that's the problem. But, you know, look, is you know, we're charging for online subscriptions to the Globe now, and we're actually doing fairly well. Last I checked, we had, I think, 43,000 subscribers. Digital only. We're paying, you know, $190 a year to subscribe to the Globe online. I think that's pretty good.
That's I'm one of them, by the way. One last question about, you mentioned advertising a couple of seconds ago. There are reports that people like Jack Connors, obviously the advertising guru from town, Fish, who is the head of Suffolk Construction, are contemplating joining Henry in this venture. Is there anything you can tell us about that?
I've heard the rumors and seen the reports as well. I'm as curious as anybody, and I don't have any more info than anybody else has. I know John Henry has said very publicly that he would like to take on partners in this. I think he enjoys working with partners. He's had a very fruitful relationship over the Red Sox with Larry Lucchino and Tom Werner, and you know, I think he's looking at having some fun in this whole process. So I think he's looking to take on partners. But I would be lying if I told you I had any idea at all who they might be.
You know, as we're speaking, Brian, we were about to move on, then I realized usually I do research of your columns before we have a conversation, and I forgot this morning. What have you written about John Henry in the past?
All good things.
Have you?
You know, I will tell you, I have, I've known him, loosely. I mean, I don't pretend to have known him well, but I've known him loosely for a decade or so, since he came to Boston. And, I have, I think, not that it matters, I think I've written pretty well about the Red Sox ownership.
Mm-hmm.
They've been good owners, last year. I think I was a little bit critical of the Red Sox ownership.
What'd you say?
I honestly don't remember. I have a vague and I will admit nagging recollection of it. And I'm testing Google to see if we can possibly purge that from the entire internet, but I have had very little luck doing that.
I think it's fair to say that you never wrote, as I did at least once, about the love letters between John Henry and his
okay,
bride.
Okay, let's move on.
You didn't write about that, did you, Brian McGroy?
I think we should take Jim's advice and move on. I did not write about that. But
I thought it was very romantic.
As did I. And anything that I did write, I have a pretty good feeling that Jim will be able to remind you very explicitly what that was on Wednesday.
Okay. Brian, I want to ask you about Paul Healy, the delivery truck driver. Your headline this morning is Globe driver thought he would not survive the crash. This was an incredible story and an incredible video that many of us looked at and were amazed he could survive the crash. How's he doing?
Our sense is he's doing very well, better than you would have expected. Having seen that crash, sounds like a really tough guy, a good guy. The video is extraordinary. Have you guys seen it?
Oh yeah,
absolutely.
Repeatedly.
I mean, it reminded me. Do you remember the show Speed Racer?
No.
I have to say I missed that one.
Back when we were kids, I mean, it was a cartoon show, and these cars would just fly off roads and crash and then keep driving. But, I mean, what happened here was a miracle. I mean, just a wonderful miracle that he was able to survive this. And, you know, the idea that somebody cut him off like has happened, and the authorities were able to catch her and charge her, is terrific. But what's more terrific is that Mr. Healy is recovering and that we expect him hopefully back to work.
You know, the Herald had a great story by John Zaremba and Jack and Carnacchio today about the woman that did hit the driver. It's unbelievable. She had 10 suspensions for failing to pay citations. Her license had already been suspended many times. She had a drunk driving thing up in Lincoln. And she gets into this big fracas with the state trooper who pulls her over. He asked her, I guess she had a bunch of EBT cards, and when he asked her about why she had multiple, she began screaming at him that he was a dumb expletive deleted, for paying for food when she gets it for free. And then she repeatedly called the state trooper a racist, told the trooper she was from Haiti and was going to put voodoo on my white expletive deleted. I mean, this woman sounds like she should not be anywhere behind the wheel of a car and may have a few screws loose.
Yeah, no, you guys did good work getting that, and she just sounds like a real piece of work, and that's a polite way to put it.
Now, Brian, last thing, just to hedge all of our bets, you want to go half on a Powerball ticket or no?
Why do I think that in any business deal with you, Jim, I'd come out on the short end of that?
Because you know me. Hey, Brian McGrory, good luck. We're really glad to talk to you, and we'll be following this thing closely. Talk to you next week.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian McGrory from the Boston Globe is with us every Wednesday. It was a little bit late today. He's supposed to be here at 1 o'clock. He's usually here at 1 o'clock. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, we're going to be joined by Christopher Lydon to talk about a new movie. Is it 20 Steps from Greatness, Jim? That's what it's called?
20 Feet from Stardom.
Okay.
20 Steps from Greatness.
I saw it last night. It
Concept
was fantastic.
Is the same. It's fantastic.
It's about background singers. It's absolutely great. But up next, there is this dance craze out in Chicago that is coming to Boston. And Edgar B. Horg III is going to bring us that story up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Chicago Steppin', there's no G, by the way. Chicago Steppin' is a dance that's been around since the 30s, has made its way to Dorchester. How did it get there? What does it mean to locals? Joining us in Studio 3 to elaborate is Edgar B. Herrick III, the man on the dance floor and behind the Curiosity Desk.
The Curiosity Desk sits on a dance floor, you guys.
As well as
it does double duty.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us, what is this step-in?
This is a really interesting subculture, right? It should be said that this dance is legitimately huge in Chicago, right? There are people, when we talk to the people who do it locally here, they say, like, you know, everybody eventually goes to the Mecca of Chicago, you know, for a trip, and you can step 7 nights a week, and there's like a local cable access show that's devoted completely to this kind of dance, right?
I watch on YouTube this morning, by the way.
It's crazy, right?
Spectacular.
It's really, really neat. And there's a couple really interesting things about it. First of all, is just how it developed, right? So it started in the swing dance era, and it traces its roots back to swing dance Lindy Hop, which was being done on the East Coast here, and then it broke off in Chicago to its own kind of thing, which for a long time was called the bop. The bop, right?
They would do it
at, you know, sort of juke joints and speakeasies, and they'd do it to the music of the era. And then sometime around the 1970s, apparently, right, is when it really got solidified as Chicago-style steppin'. The bop had, like, grown into what is officially called Chicago-style steppin', and they all trace it back to this one song, apparently, right? As disco was hitting, there was a group of people who weren't really into doing the hustle. They wanted to keep doing the bop, and there was one song that they found that they could do this to perfectly, and there was a station, WMBX, in Chicago, right, where it would get requested all the time. It was a song by an artist called Jeffrey. It never charted. It was a huge hit locally in Chicago. The song's called Love's Gonna Last. Let's listen to a little bit of
okay.
it.
Okay.
And the key here is that slow groove. And that's how that, you know, this dance is done to this slow groove. And so what's interesting about it is, unlike a lot of other dance crazes, right, it's not necessarily being done by people in their teens and 20s or even in their 30s. There are young people who step, of course, but generally the thing that is happening is this thing is now exporting to cities, including Boston, from Chicago, and the people who are doing it are in their 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s.
Something to look forward to.
And this community's growing in urban cities like in Detroit. It's huge. It's really big in Atlanta. It's big in cities in New Jersey. It's starting to get bigger here in Boston thanks to this group of people who are doing it here. And again, 40s, 50s, 60s. It's cool.
When you hit 80s, then I knew I could do it. Now, Edgar B. Herrick III,
yes.
This is not a visual medium, but the challenge for you, describe it as best you can. What does it look like? I've seen it.
One of the things that you could use to describe it is the name, Stepan. And that's like a good way, I think it's a good name for it because it's not a lot of, it's very smooth, right? And when it's done properly, you sort of just look like you're stepping around each other a little
bit. Like step dancing. For like step dancing.
It's a partner dance, so it's typically done between two people. That's usually a male and a female with the male being the lead. Although, when they have competitions, there's also competitions with two males dancing together, which has its kind of own unique thing, where they kind of do a back and forth, but they're also showing each other up a little bit, right? They're also in a little bit of a battle. And then it's also done in trios. Typically a guy and two girls. But anyway, it's a lead dance. So it's one person leading, the other person following, facing each other. And they just – it's a slow groove. They kind of walk forward and back, then to the side. There's a little bit of turning of the hips and turning of the arms. They'll do some spins. They've got all these names for – the double left pass, the triple left underarm pass.
Is there a dress code? I mean, are there rules of the road?
There's definitely rules of the road. Like when we went down to Dorchester, the Carver Den, they do this every Thursday night, right, down at this Mason Hall in Dorchester, which is just a terrific space. You walk in, you know, they've got a bar. There's some people at the bar. There's some guys playing cards at a table. And then there's this group of people over at the end of the place, and they get their step on. You know, they have a step and set, as they're called. When they do that, it's just a practice session. You know, it's just kind of T-shirt and jeans and stuff. But the culture of stepping, right, is also sort of a throwback culture. Since the dance does have its roots in the 30s, for example, here they call each other gentleman and lady. And the whole idea is when you're dancing, you go up to a lady and you are a gentleman, you ask her to dance. You take her out on the dance floor. She is your follow and you are her man for those 4 minutes you're dancing. Then you escort her back to your seat, right?
Ooh. Like Marjorie's a great dancer, like by the way. You love this, don't you?
You know what's one of the great sad things about it, for the last 20 years? I mean, there isn't that great partner dancing. I mean,
absolutely.
You go to a wedding and it's kind of pathetic. The bride and groom, they can't dance.
They don't know how to do it.
They don't know how to dance. And you think about, you know, the great swing bands and the great in the 30s and 40s when people would dance. Or like, you know, when I grew up, there was a great place, this Rose Ball dance room where everybody would go and dance on the weekends. It was really
people
fun.
People would do the jitterbug.
Yeah.
People would do swing dancing.
Yeah.
You know.
Men generally don't know how to dance anymore.
Well, we don't teach it. I mean, you know what I mean? There's been a resurgence in some places. You know, salsa is certainly rising in popularity.
Yes.
That's something that a lot of people are interested in doing, and that's a partner dance. But it's interesting. They have that challenge even here. Jim, to get back to your question before, which I actually didn't answer about the dress code. So they do. They have these events, right? And they have what's called a white party, and everybody wears white. Or they
that's
have a
great.
Black party,
that's
and everybody wears black.
Everybody was dressed in white.
It's so cool. So
it's
and it's, they like to do a dress-up affair again because it's throwback to the culture when you got dressed up in your Sunday best, you went out, and you danced like gentlemen and ladies. But, I mean, I think, Marjorie, you know, salsa, swing dancing, which is also something that continues to grow in popularity, and this, which is growing in popularity, they all kind of have the same challenge, which falls on the guy.
It does.
Every one of them sort of says, you know, we have a ton of women who want to do this, and we don't have a lot of guys. And secretly, like what kind of off the record when you talk to dancers, what they'll tell you is guys give up really easily. They don't like it because they don't get it right away, because there are rules to it. You know, we live in a culture now where it's, you know, since the 60s on, it's been very much your own personal identity, right? Like what is your individual bliss? And dancing certainly takes that on too. And like a lot of people, even people you talk to that who love to dance, they're expressing themselves individually. That's not what partner dancing is about. It is about it, but it's about expressing yourself with a partner.
Are you're doing a piece on Greater Boston?
We are tonight.
So we'll see it.
So we'll be able to see it.
No, but that's not the question.
Yeah.
We don't want to know if we see it. We want to know if we see you doing it.
I bet you are a good dancer, Edgar.
I can't reveal for sure, but
I can't tell you whether I dove into the Charles or not.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No, I did. I did. I'm dancing bit in it.
Tell the truth. Come on.
I wasn't too bad.
I bet you're a good dancer.
I dance.
Good.
It's something
I
do. It's something kind of that I do in my spare time fairly regularly. So I do partner dancing. So it wasn't as foreign to me, I think, as it would be to a lot of people.
So this Dorchester group is starting to do this in the Mason Hall when they're just practicing.
Yeah.
Do they perform somewhere when they get dressed up in their outfits?
Yeah.
And
I mean,
do
they do like big, you know, their regular thing is Thursdays, but they have parties or, you know, they have events where they do it out in the park and you can kind of go see them do it. But honestly, what I love about this group and what I think What I was really excited about doing this piece for Greater Boston is that they're not necessarily performers. They're regular people. You know what I mean? We're talking to them. One guy's a bus driver. The other lady works for the city of Boston. Another lady lives in Stoughton and works for the court system in Stoughton. You know, one guy says he likes to get exercise. Another lady likes the social aspect of it. I mean, they're regular people. And they're getting together because they love this dance. They're getting together to dance. They're, you know, none of them are going to become – none of them are, like, aspiring to go on to So You Could Think You Can Dance. You know?
Okay, we only have a minute left. We're going to play a little music you're going to identify. And can you use those 60 seconds to show Marjorie? Now, I'm the only one who will get to see this. A little Chicago stepping. Can
right,
you do
let's,
this?
Let's do it. Let's adjust
what's
the
music we're listening to?
This is a little R. Kelly. One of the interesting things about this dance is they can do it to anything that's kind of slow, whether it's old or new. This
Marjorie's
is a
up.
Newer R&B song.
Edgar's up.
All right, here's how they count it, Marjorie.
Good.
Let's get the count here, right? Two, seven, eight. One and two.
This is very sexy for those
four,
who are not in
seven,
studio.
Eight. One, two, three. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Okay. While they're doing this tomorrow on Boston Public Radio, Paul Sternberg, executive director of the Mass Lottery, joins us, and Chris Lydon will discuss with us something we've both seen too, 20 Feet from Stardom, one of the great new films. And I'm about 5 feet from stardom as Edgar and Marjorie really go out. Edgar, that was fabulous.
Edgar is a great dancer. Oh, wow. Let's do some
Everybody's
stepping,
Edgar. Sweating in the studio now. Hey, have a great day. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back tomorrow at noon. I'm Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan. You should see Jim Rumba.
See you guys.